Okay, well, good class this morning. Thank you for coming. We are in the last two chapters before we get to the last section of Isaiah, which starts in chapter 60. Chapter 60 is a very, very famous chapter. I'm going to ask, does anybody know why that would be? This would be a real, if you get this one, I'm really going to be impressed. Isaiah 60, why is it an impressive or noteworthy chapter? And since I don't have time to wait forever for an answer, I will give you the answer. The answer is this is the chapter that Jesus quotes to the Pharisees at Nazareth when they were asking him, this young guy came from their home country, hometown, so how can this person be anybody? And so that is the end of it. But when he shows up at the synagogue, they gave him the roll, and he read from Isaiah chapter 60. And what's unusual about that particular reading, does anybody know? He stopped reading at a certain point. Yeah, you want to see it? Yeah. He stopped when the day of vengeance, and he stops. And he doesn't go on into the rest of it. So anyway, that's chapter 60. We'll deal with that next week. So, and I think it's kind of like on a racetrack, we've been running on the final turn, and now we're heading for the home race or the home run. And is that what you call a home? What's the part of the stretch? Thank you. Now we're into the stretch with chapter 60. That's only six chapters, so you know we're almost finished with the book. So anyway, we'll do that next week. But before that, we have these two chapters actually go with the first two chapters of a four-chapter section, 56, 57, 58, and 59. We did 56, 57 last week, and 58 and 59 really are similar in tone and purpose. And we have some very famous verses that we memorized in 57, and there's a couple in 58, or actually in 59 this week as well. So again, I think we love Isaiah because of these pithy verses, and we may not always understand the context of those verses, and that's why we're doing the book for us. So we're detectives looking for evidence in Isaiah, unusual times. Okay, so a little bit of sidetrack here, because since this is the same kind of theme we had last week, I wanted to do a little bit more of an application with this lesson for our day. So we've been studying Isaiah, a prophetic book written in the 8th century BC, and is written basically to Judah. But Israel certainly is listening in, and we as Christians are listening in now some, 2,800 years later. The message not only of these chapters, but really of the book, is to seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near. Always an invitation for those that are thirsty. We started in 56, talks about the folly of unrighteousness, and only one form of unrighteousness is this drunkenness. You can be drunk with wine, you're drunk with power. So if Isaiah 56 talks about the folly of the unrighteous, one of which is all forms of drunkenness, but a folly is a folly no matter where and when he lives. Thus, Isaiah's truth has application for any age, even our age. And that's why these verses that are in Isaiah, 2,800 years old, works so well for us today. Well, what about other leaders in the world? Are they not subject to the same standard to do right? In other words, are not all leaders, or actually all people in the world, responsible to do the right thing? Is anybody off the hook for whatever reason? Well, the question I have here to contemplate, we can profitably make direct comparison between any leader in the world, in our church, or in our city, with the standards that are set for the leaders of Israel. There aren't two standards. Israel has one, and everybody else has another. So it has become axiomatic that it is true, with rare exceptions, that leaders tend towards self-serving and corruption. And do I get an amen? No, thank you. Seems like that just always happens. A good person goes to Washington, for example, and he gets corrupted, so it seems. Well, our nation, the United States, is not the same kind of chosen nation as Israel. Our nation and its leadership is still personally bound to God they claim to honor. You know, they can't, well, they're not Christians, therefore. No, they're not Christians, but they honor, they say they honor God. They do. You hear that a lot. And it's sort of like maybe they almost forgot to say it. That is true to its establishment of the nation, its laws, its morals and freedoms and personal responsibility are meant or engineered or determined because they honor God, because they come from God. It is, after all, as we say in our Pledge of Allegiance, one nation under God. I think we still say that in the schools. By the way, that under God was only added in 1954 when Eisenhower added it. Interesting how things have come. Can you imagine that addition made to the Pledge of Allegiance today? The argument that would go on about it? Well, as long as the God-authored governing principles are upheld in a nation, reflected in their leadership, the nation will flourish in filling and subduing the earth. Remember, no one escapes the mandate in Genesis. All the nations are here to subdue the earth and to fill the earth and subdue it. No one can escape that mandate. The United States of America has been the best, has the best record of all the nations. Millions, even the Jews, have benefited from a people that have imperfectly honored God. And by the way, not all citizens need to be born again for the nations to flourish. In fact, it may only be a minority that are actually born again. But if they function according to God's principles, there is a benefit. So a truism, nations that honor God will be the target of destruction by the enemy introduced in the garden. We know who that is. Now here's one verse, if you always have a verse to memorize, well, here's one you can memorize, and I think it really works fine in these days. Isaiah 59:15 says, "He who turns aside from evil makes himself a prey to evil." Yes, you do. It's almost like you cannot open your mouth in favor of the unborn without being called evil. You cannot even express a dissatisfaction with the gender identity transitions that we have today because the evil will attack you. Interesting how this is a principle in the Old Testament, that he who turns aside from evil, doesn't want to do evil things, is makes himself a prey. And my wife always worries about what I'm going to say in class. So she makes this comment. I told her what's going to do, and so that's the concern. If I don't turn toward evil, I will make myself a prey. So if I say what's good, those guys out there will come for me. Now, at this point, I'm pretty much a small potatoes guy. No one's really going to pay much attention to me, but that may not always be true. But the fact is that if you turn aside from the wrong, you will become a victim of the evil one. Interesting. So we can trace the tendency towards infidelity in all history. And we say Israel is only one example. And that's why Israel is such a good example for us, because they are a good example. Founding America in its founding in 1776 and so forth has demonstrated that God-ordained principles of freedom, responsibility, etc. I gave you some of those, the moral principles from creation. In recent years, this has become visible. I first of all said once, and then I saw something else happen, and it's almost on a daily basis, I say weeks, there's something happens that the moral principles are being attacked. So it is like, well, 2 years ago this happened. It's like now something happens every month or every week. So in recent years, visible by the weeks or the months, these principles are that made the nation a model for nations are being attacked. These principles, one by one, are being chipped away. Well, we honored the king. Romans 13 says we better. Yet, is there not a place to call out the destructive rebellion rampant everywhere? And I think that we had that from our pastor a couple of weeks ago on the gay, Pride Month. Yeah, there we go. You know, they don't only have a Pride Month. There's about the five other events they have during the year. You know, it's a weekend for this and a weekend for that. So this is just one of the things that they're pushing. And I notice now that in the center flag in the Capitol, they show the pride flag and United States flags on either side. And that's probably an illegal thing. In any other place, they would call it treason. So is there not a place to call them out? It is clear that an atheistic system has captured the mind of the rebellious leaders and all the institutions of influence. There are none left that have not been affected by this. The objective has shifted from honoring God to blaspheming him. It was almost like you with the rainbow, they're poking a stick in God's eye. Said, well, the rainbow really belonged to Noah, but it really belongs to us. It's a blaspheming statement. Leaders who use its institutions use it to destroy the God-given order. So the question is it proper to recognize their failure, or do we just turn a blind eye? And I would say I don't think it's possible for Christians to turn a blind eye and say, well, it doesn't matter. Surely Christians will talk about the consequences of the failure, and I have talked with you and many people about this. But none of you have suggested we organize, which is a good thing. It is true that the church cannot be political. In other words, you can't go man against man. But it has a responsibility to teach and uphold biblical principles for its people. That's why you're here, and that's why I'm talking to you. I'm not talking about them, I'm talking to you. God against fallen man, which is what's going on, attacks on God can be subtle, and that's sometimes why we need to have it pointed out. I like to read editorials in the papers, and there are people that are not believers make observations that believers can't make sometimes because they see things that are happening on the inside that we are not aware of. So the church of all people needs instruction in biblical truth of morality and responsibility. And certainly our children, especially if they're in the public school, they are indoctrinated with the false. And somebody needs to say, no, that's not right. So the genius of this non-political power, which you represent here, is the restrainer that lives in us. The genius of a non-political power is in the value of each member's moral influence on any issue. You just sit there in your neighborhood and you are an influence. And I know we're supposed to say words, but I still say a person is in your neighborhood probably knows who you are. Because it is the Lord of the church who is in unifying the authority of his people. And this is what is so frustrating from those that are trying to change things. They cannot get to us or to us as a class. Because you'd have to go after each one of them separately. You can't go after us as a class. All right, so that's the power that God has in the spirit, in the hearts of believers. They just do what's right. And in the aggregate, then the right thing is done or the right thing is said. Okay, now back to the nation of Israel and Judah. The prophet speaks for God and the righteous in the nation. Sometimes I'm not sure exactly whether the prophet is talking about the leaders in the nation or are they talking about the followers. They kind of lump together, but it would be true if a leader or a follower does unrighteous things, it should be called out. So the prophet speaks for God and the righteous in the nation by calling out their sins, their failures. So the message of these chapters, 56 to 59, is to appeal to the nation and their leaders to choose the right course. Remember, to seek the Lord while he may be found. That is the invitation. But alas, in the end, they will not turn to God on their own. Surprising, God will intervene for them and save the nation. It seems like, why would God not just abandon them? But he doesn't. He does not do that. He intervenes and saves them as a nation. And there will be left in its wake a destruction, the tribulation, wreckage of failed leadership. So the text goes this way. I got the megaphone. Cry loudly, do not hold back. Raise your voice like a trumpet, declare to my people their transgression in the house of Jacob for their sins. We've had this so many times in Isaiah, so we have it another time. God is calling not only the leadership, but all of Israel to repentance. And so the argument would be, well, what do they say? Well, they say, we are doing okay. We're doing the right thing. And so God almost, what's the word, mocks them in irony. Yet they seek me day by day and delight to know my ways. Now, that sounds like that's what they ought to be doing. But they really aren't. They just act like they are. As a nation that has done righteous, they act like that. And have not forsaken the ordinance of God, they act like that. They ask me for just decisions, they act like that. They delight in the nearness of God, they act like that. But they don't really do it. So why have we fasted and you do not see, they would say. See, well, we've done everything we could, after all, and you ignore us, God. Why, we have humbled ourselves and you did not notice. I mean, we've done everything you could possibly do and you haven't noticed us. We're in bad shape. Behold, on the day of your fast, you find your desires and drive hard all your work. See, this, the argument flips back and forth. So here now is the counter to that. Behold, on the day of your fast, you find not God's desire, but your desires, and drive hard all your workers. Behold, you fast for contention and strife and to strike with wicked fists. This must be some group that get into fights over in their fast. They hit each other. You do not fast like you do today to make your voice heard on high. In other words, they fast to have their own word heard, but they don't try to make their word heard in God's ears. So it's totally opposite. There was shallow disobedience, and irony is used to point that out. Now, superficially, still going on, it is a fast which, like this which I chose, a day for a man to humble himself. Is this what it's supposed to be? Is it for bowing, right? One said like a reed, and for speaking out, spreading out sackcloth like ashes as a bed. Will you call this a fast, even acceptable to the Lord? In other words, this is another taunt. This is what you expect? No, this is true service. Is this not the fast which I choose, God chooses? To loosen the bonds of the wicked, to undo the bonds of the yoke, bands of the yoke, and to let the oppressed go free and break every yoke. In other words, do the right thing for people. Don't be oppressive to them. And the religion pays no attention to the oppression of other people, and it's all self-serving, and God is pointing this out to them. So, true service, is it not to divide your bread with the hungry and to bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? That's not what they're doing. So the true benefit then would be, then your light will break out like at the dawn, and your recovery will speedily spring forth, and your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. Okay, that's not happening, so that they're being called out for that. So there's hope when you do this. Then you will call, and the Lord will answer you your cry, and you will cry, and he will say, here I am. If you remove the yoke from your midst, the pointing of the finger and the speaking wickedness, no, quit doing the pointing to other people. And if you give yourself to the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then your light will rise in the darkness and your gloom will become like midday. Now, I have to admit, when you read how the Israelites are supposed to respond in their fast, it does have a lot of what seems to be a work-oriented religion. Well, remember, in Israel, their governmental duties and the church, or I should say synagogue duties or temple duties, are all kind of bound together. We didn't have that separate. So like we don't have the responsibility to feed the hungry and the poor and that kind of stuff. That's an Israel application. It doesn't fit for the church because that's part of the law. We're not part of the law. But obedience is to the law was part of the Old Testament. And obedience to God's law is part of the New Testament, even though the law is written a little bit differently. So we can still apply. So, and the Lord will continue to guide you, satisfy your desire in scorched places, and give strength to your bones, and you will be like a watered garden, like a spring of water, whose waters do not fail. This is the hope they have. And I thought the imagery we have of the New Jerusalem, where we have the waters coming down, and it waters the plants, and it yields fruit. And so this idea of water and refreshment and life is typical of the kingdom, the eternal kingdom, because it is an expression of life that we need. And when we are, nothing is more precious to anyone than water when you're thirsty. Remember that we just started this, where, you know, those of you that are thirsty come to the waters. So the picture here probably reflects a little bit on where this is going in the New Jerusalem. Well, in the eschaton, in the end time, those from among you will rebuild the ancient ruins, and you'll raise up the age-old foundations, and you'll be called to repair the breach, the restore of the streets in which to dwell. Now, I think this is probably kind of hyperbole, because I don't think God's going to ask anybody to rebuild the city for the kingdom, because God's going to do that. But the spirit of this is what's being said here. You look forward to the days when those ancient ruins will be rebuilt and those age-old foundations will be set again. You'll be called to prepare the breach. So you're part of this because you're part of the kingdom, and you get the credit for it. Restore the streets in which to dwell. All right, this talks about kingdom dwelling, no doubt. Because of the Sabbath, you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure. This is the right way to do the Sabbath. Because of the Sabbath, you turn your foot from doing your own pleasure on my holy day and call the Sabbath a delight. It's not a burden. A holy day on the Lord, honorable, and honor it. Desisting from your own ways, from seeking your own pleasure and speaking your own words. So opposite we had in the beginning. Then you will take delight in the Lord, and I will make you ride on the heights of the earth, and I will feed you with the heritage of Jacob, your fathers, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. So again, we have that look into the future, into the eschaton. Okay, now that's kind of like one chapter. Now, the next chapter is sort of astounding. The sensitive may wonder about the ability of this change of heart that is going to be necessary that we have seen in the last section. Well, surprise of all surprise, for this we need the grace of God. You know, if it were me, I'd just abandon and go on. They're not worth saving. Well, God doesn't look at it that way. I'm not God for lots of reasons. But he has grace. So here's the question. We have all this piled up sin and all these piled up evildoers. And so we would say they're useless, they're helpless, they're worthless. And then the Lord comes and says, behold, the Lord's hand is not so short that it cannot save. These people we throw in the garbage heap, God will save. Nor is the ear so dull that he cannot hear. Now, we sometimes say that God doesn't hear the prayer of a sinner. This prayer he does hear. Okay? So we don't have to look very far to find people that you know, or you may want be one even yourself, who was the one on the trash heap, but God pulled you out and saved you. And then we identify with this grace. So that is a good thing. Behold, the Lord's hand is not so short that it cannot save. That really includes everybody. God could have saved Hitler. God could have saved Stalin. God could have saved anybody in Washington these days. And some of them are saved, and they're retching over what's going on. But the problem is that your iniquities have made a separation between you and your God. Here's another one of those verses we use and memorize. And your sins have hidden his face from you so that he does not hear. See, those are the people that God is going to save with his not-so-short hand. Okay, those are the ones he's going to save. Now, he goes into this trash heap, what they looked like before they were saved. And here again, you see all the parallels we have with any leadership in the world, and even in our country today, we see what they do. For your hands are defiled with blood, and your fingers with iniquity. Your lips have spoken falsehood. Your tongues mutter wickedness. No one sues righteously. They sue, but not righteously. And no one pleads honestly. They trust in confusion and speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. Now, isn't that not what we see even in our country today? No doubt that was true in Israel, but it is wherever sinful men congregate and they are in charge, and they are not controlled by the God-honoring principles that we started with, this is where it goes. What's to stop them? So we have blood, we have all kinds of abortion, we have people killed that should not be killed. Everything goes toward, and I don't have to go through this. It's horrible, and this is exactly what's happening. They turn everything upside down. The ones that should die live, and the ones that live should die. Remember, these are ones that God will save. Some of them. This is not done yet. They hatch adder's snake eggs and weave the spider's web. you know, you hatch it, you hatch a plan, and you get caught up in a spider's web. He who eats of their eggs dies, and from that which is crushed, a snake breaks forth, and the webs will not become clothing, nor will they cover themselves with their works. Their works are of iniquity, and an act of violence is in their hand. Their feet run to evil, and they hasten to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are the thoughts of iniquity. Devastation and destruction are in their pathway. Very familiar, doesn't it? Kind of read your newspapers these days. They do not know the way of peace. There is no justice in their tracks. They have made their paths crooked. Whoever treads on them does not know peace. Therefore, justice is far from us, and righteousness does not overtake us. We hope for light, but behold darkness. For brightness, but we walk in gloom. We grope along the wall like blind men. We grope like those who have no eyes. We stumble at midday as in the twilight. Among those who are vigorous, we are like dead men. All of us growl like bears. And it's almost like, you know, not only is it the leadership, but it's actually the warp of the fabric of the human culture of Israel. They all do this. All of us growl like bears and moan sadly like doves. And hope for justice, but there is none. For salvation, but it is far from us. For our transgressions are multiplied before you, and our sins testify against you. For our transgressions are with us, and we know our iniquities. Transgression and denying the Lord, turning away from God, speaking oppression, revolt, conceiving in and uttering from the heart lying words. Justice is turned back. Righteousness stands far away. For truth has stumbled in the street, and righteousness cannot enter. Yes, truth is lacking, and he who turns aside from evil makes himself a prey. There's our verse. He who turns aside from evil makes himself a prey. After you have this all, you resist all of these things, you become a prey. Now the Lord saw, and it was displeasing in his sight, that there was no justice. Now we have a break. And he saw that there was no man. All of these guys are going to continue to do the same thing. And he saw there was no man, and was astonished that there was no one to intercede. You know, like as if God steps back and says, there's got to be somebody. One of these is going to be an exception. We know he knows. Then his own arm brought salvation to them. His arm is not so short that he cannot save. And his righteousness upheld him. So that's how that ends. He put on righteousness like a breastplate. And a helmet, this is God now. He put on righteousness as a breastplate and a helmet of salvation on his head. And he put on garments of vengeance for clothing and wrapped himself with zeal in a mantle. Does that sound like Ephesians chapter 4, chapter 6? According to these deeds, so he will repay. God has these clothing, and now Ephesians chapter 6 says that we should put them on. According to their deeds, he will repay. Wrath to his adversaries, recompense to his enemies, to the coastlines, far out nations, he will make recompense. So they will fear the name of the Lord from the west. And this is the eschaton. This is where they are, the gathering of Israel again at the end. So they will fear the name of the Lord from the west, and his glory from the rising sun, which will be the east. For he will come like a rushing stream, which the wind of the Lord drives. It will be brought back to the land. The Redeemer will come to Zion. Lord will come to Zion, second advent. And those who turn from transgressions in Jacob will be saved, declares the Lord. As for me, this is my covenant with them, God says. My spirit which is upon you, and my words which I have put in your mouth, shall not depart from my mouth, from your mouth, nor from the mouth of your offspring, from the mouth of your offspring's offspring. So this is a multi-generation, and according to way Fruchtbaum looks at this, is all generation Jews will be saved. Once they get into the kingdom, there will be no more lost Jews. I think that's what it's saying here as well. Okay, so we have 10 minutes here. In the section 56 to 59, four chapters of the challenge has been put to the people and the nation to hear the message and become part of the kingdom in Eschaton. The section ends with the sobering truth that no one will choose life and live. That is amazing. God must intervene in grace to accomplish it. So what is good about Isaiah is that even as a prophecy, it is useful for our daily living. We are given insight into leadership of Israel, but it is fully true of all leadership that loses its way in following God. Disasters come to any nation whose leaders forget the real sovereign and take the authority to themselves. but they are woefully inadequate to guarantee even their own survival. In fact, I think as we watch what they're doing today, they are actually destroying themselves. I mean, when you abort the children for the next generation, who will be the next generation? We live in a day where anything is possible, they think, at least in the minds of the powerful in authority. But it takes only a few minutes of watching any YouTube report. I do this all the time to see how man has taken charge of nature or everything, and that their meddling will only make life impossible. Whatever they do makes things more difficult for us. It doesn't improve anything. Just for a couple examples, they've had a lot of difficulties in the western part of our state with water. We've just gone through a period of time when the Lake Mead and so forth were down at record levels, and everybody thought they were going to die of thirst, and they were rationing water and all that kind of stuff. But they won't build any more dams to collect the water, because the water has to be preserved for these little fish that would die if they don't have them have access to them. So we pile up the water. You can't do that. So the fish are given, you know, the man is sacrificed on benefit of the fish. That's an old story. Manage the water in the California and Nevada region on the Colorado River will end up causing unnamed disasters because man is not God, thus very limited. Man thinks he can control this, and now he's got the power to do it and the regulation forces to do it. So this is going to be very, very difficult for those that live in California. They will be glad they left. And water is more important than oil. You know how that story goes. Godly wisdom says, do not favor politics. Godly wisdom says, do not favor policies that will put 40 million people in its risk. That's 40 million people in that plain area where fish are protected, but agricultural waters, which we needed for life for mankind, are denied. Godly wisdom says, do not expect that in the sparsely populated areas of the earth where the sun shines longest and the wind blows the strongest, that electric lines can be built over thousands of miles to deliver power to populated ports of the earth. It's impossible. Was it God's wisdom to encourage 40 million to live in virtual desert conditions in the southwest United States, or to who will shoot each other over water rights? I remember going back to the old movie with George, what's his name? I call it Chinatown, water rights in San Francisco. It's an old story there. They live in a desert. Was it God's wisdom that man should live below sea level in the Gulf of Mexico region? But man is wise. He has built dams to keep water in and keep water out. That fixes the problem. But dams overrun and claim lives and the comforts of these regions are soon forgotten when bureaucratic regulations are not able to mitigate disasters. And I'd say expect more to come. So no longer are these disasters the act of God. Now they've become the acts of men, and some men are held responsible to it. Now, we do not claim to have the wisdom of God to regulate the complex world under judgment, which is a complex world under judgment, no doubt about it, and there will be people that will die. What we are saying is that the leadership of Israel functioned as if they were doing God's work. We see the same impulse that man is doing God's work without regarding him as God. And in my book, this changes everything, and only disaster looms. And here we have again this encouragement. Behold, the Lord's hand is not so short that it cannot save, nor his ear so dull that it cannot hear. So herein is the glory of God, that not only can he save these rebels, he does save them for the kingdom.